You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up after Tuesday's primary contest, Joe Biden now leads Bernie Sanders by more than 150 delegates in the race for the Democratic nomination for president. We'll look at the issues in the campaign coming up. Now, if you've been following the news over the last few weeks, you'll have noticed a lot of growing anxiety around the state of the stock market due to concerns around the novel coronavirus. The Dow Jones, a major industry index, dropped more than 9.3% during this morning's opening hour of trading, and the S&P 500 fell enough this morning that it triggered an industry-wide trading pause. In an effort to keep the market stable, it was just announced today that the Federal Reserve will inject $1.5 trillion into lending markets and will buy roughly $60 billion worth of Treasury bonds for the next month. For people who aren't experts in the market, we might get the gist that the Dow going down is bad. But what is the Dow? What goes into the number? And is it the best way to measure the health of the stock market or the overall economy? Bjorn Araker is the Bill Nygren Chair of Investments and Professor of Finance at the Wisconsin School of Business at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Bjorn, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
Well, before we get into some Dow 101, just what's your reaction to the market's little bit of ups and a whole lot of downs over the last week or two?
So the market was down 10% today, which is the largest percentage drop since 1987. And so it's a pretty dramatic loss. It comes on top of the other losses that we had previously this month. So in total, we're down about 30%. So, it's a significant loss.
So what goes into that number? We hear it every day on the news, NPR. They'll end their newscast every time with what the Dow did. They might throw in the S&P 500. They might throw in NASDAQ. Always the Dow. What does the number mean?
So the Dow is essentially, you can think about it as a portfolio of 30 different stocks. The stocks are largely big blue chip companies, Microsoft, Apple, and so forth, and these stocks have prices, and obviously they trade at a given point in time. The Dow essentially measures the value of this portfolio of these 30 stocks, and it's used as a measure of what the overall market is doing at a given point in time. If you log into your retirement account or if you look at your stock market portfolio, you will find that on a given day, it probably went in the same direction as the Dow or the S&P 500 because stocks are heavily correlated. And so if you have a portfolio of stock in your retirement portfolio, it probably went in the same direction as the Dow. If the Dow goes down 10%, the likelihood is that your stock market portfolio probably suffered a similar, maybe smaller, maybe bigger, but a similar size loss.
And the roster of companies on the Dow has changed a lot over the years, right? The original Dow roster, most of those companies are no longer with us.
That's correct. So right now, as I said, we have companies like Boeing, Apple, Microsoft, Johnson & Johnson, and so forth. And obviously these companies weren't around 100 years ago when the Dow was still being computed off of obviously a different basket of companies.
Who picks? Who says this is a Dow company, this one isn't?
Oh, I honestly do not know. This is computed by, it's a private company that computes it, and they can compute whichever one they want. But they are largely large cap blue chip companies that trade on the NYSE. There's a couple of other ones, including Walgreens, Microsoft, which trades on NASDAQ and so forth. But they're largely New York Stock Exchange companies. The S&P 500 is a larger, more broadly based index that consists of 500 different stocks. And this is the one that I think nowadays most people pay more attention to. But again, that is the 500 biggest stocks in the U.S. stock market, and they're value weighted, meaning that they are the weight that they make up in the index is proportional to their market capitalization.
Bjorn Erocker is with us from UW-Madison's Wisconsin School of Business. We're looking at the Dow and other indicators of the stock market and the economy. Bjorn, as you said, the Dow gives us a pretty general sense of what might be happening in someone's retirement account or investment portfolio. Are there limits as to what the Dow can tell us about the stock market?
Are there limits? Well, it's a pretty good indicator. Like I said, you know, the Dow goes down 10% like it did today, the likelihood is that if you have stocks, you lost money. You may not be 10%, but it may be, you know, something smaller or larger than that. But it is a pretty good indicator of what's happening. You see today the S&P is down about the same amount, about 9.5%. You know, these things move in lockstep pretty much.
And then there are questions, you know, sometimes people use the Dow as a metaphor, an indicator of the American economy as a whole. To what extent does that work? To what extent does it not work?
Well, that's a good question. I think the stock market has a tendency of looking forward. So right now, there's a lot of uncertainty. We don't know exactly what's going to happen with the state of the economy as we go forward, as we go through this crisis. And it's the problem is, since we don't know, we know for a fact it's probably going to lead to a recession. We just don't know exactly how long and how deep that recession will be. And so the stock market as a whole will respond negatively to this. And as a result, the prices have gone down significantly since just a month ago when they were at all-time highs.
You mentioned go ahead.
Yeah. No, so it's a pretty good indicator of what investors think is going to happen in the future. You know, it's not always, you know, an accurate indicator, but it is an indicator, and it's important in itself, because if prices go down and volatility goes up as much as it has, then it becomes difficult for companies to go out and finance their activities.
You mentioned volatility, and you told our producer about an index that I wasn't familiar with that measures volatility, the VIX or the VIX, yeah. or maybe it's Roman numerals, 5, 1, 10, I don't know. But the VIX index, what does that tell us?
So the VIX index is largely interpreted as a measure of annualized volatility. What's volatility, you might ask? And volatility is generally the amount for which you can expect the stock market, in this case the S&P 500 index, to move up and down from one day to the next. So, for example, if we can expect a move up and down to be 1%, we say that the volatility or standard deviation, which is a statistical concept, but the standard deviation or volatility of the stock market is 1%. So the standard deviation of the S&P 500 is 1%. Now, the volatility varies over time, so that when, like now, we have periods with very high volatility, this measure, any measure of volatility that you construct, will be higher than average. And right now, the VIX is at 75 or 76 was the closing value for the VIX today. And which means that it is extremely volatile. The normal range for the VIX, the average value of the VIX historically is about 19 or 20. If you go back just a couple of months ago, it was in the teens. It was in the low teens, and it has been as low as below 10. And now it is at 76, which we haven't seen levels like that since 2008. In fact, so it's indicative of a very volatile, very nervous market, and it's indicative of the fact that prices change very dramatically from one moment to the next, one day to the next.
Yeah, while you were talking, I just pulled up a chart of the last 5 years of the VIX index. I wish I could show it on the radio. This is a huge jump over the last, weeks here, a few days even. Even if I didn't know anything, I would look at this chart and say, this means something.
Yeah, it means something. The interpretation of it, if you divide it by you know, like my interpretation one day to the next, this, the interpretation of it, it's so-called annualized, which means that it's interpretable as an annualized quantity. So that 75 means that, you know, the market interprets the current environment as if the prices could go down 75% in a year or up 75%. So that's the idea of a standard deviation. So the VIX now is at the highest level. It's, like you said, it's gone up significantly now just in the last several days since this coronavirus epidemic became a problem. And now it's at record levels, and it's indicative of a very, very nervous market. And, so we can probably expect it to remain high for a while until we get some kind of resolution of the uncertainty.
Talking to Bjorn Urakker, Bill Nygren, Chair of Investments and Professor of Finance at the Wisconsin School of Business at UW-Madison. He's with us to explain the Dow Jones and stock market volatility in light of the panic over the coronavirus. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question over how the overall stock market works, what it means when it goes up and down, what measures like the Dow, the NASDAQ, the S&P 500, this VIX volatility index we've been talking about, what they mean, how they work? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Please note, we're not taking calls about specific financial, investment, or portfolio advice. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about the stock market, how it's being impacted by fears surrounding the novel coronavirus, and how to look at market volatility. Bjorn Urakker is with us from the UW-Madison's Wisconsin School of Business. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions about how the stock market works, what the indexes like the Dow Jones or S&P 500 work, what it all means. Call in at 800-642-1234. Again, we'll not be taking calls about individual investment advice. Let's go to your calls now. Kevin is with us in Black Earth. Kevin, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to ask about, Kevin?
Yeah, here's my question. When things like this are happening, and they occur, as we know, now and then, who's doing the buying of these stocks that people are trying to sell off, hoping to, you know, hold the value that they have? Who's buying them when you buy one, or one day they go down 4%, now today 10%? Who's gambling on that?
Kevin, thanks for the call. Bjorn, any thoughts?
Well, there's always going to be a buyer for every seller. So when so Kevin is right about to ask the question. At a given point in time, there's always going to be buyers in the marketplace. So for that reason, it's sort of a misnomer to call it a sell-off. But he's right. I don't know the specific individuals who were buying today. I can tell you I bought some Amazon stock the other day myself, and it hasn't been a very good investment. But at any given point in time, there will be buyers out there. There may be other individuals. There may be computers. There may be companies, pension funds, whomever trade stock on a regular basis.
Thanks a lot for that call. So the idea would be, if I'm that buyer, as things go down, I'm assessing the current market and saying, okay, I think it's bottoming out or near bottoming out. So this is a smart time to buy it because it's going to go back up. Those are the people out there buying, even as the prices are going down. Is that a fair, probably overgeneralization?
Well, it's a simplification,
right?
Obviously, but at a given point in time, there may be other people buying and selling and trying to make money doing that. So there's always going to be buyers out there. For that reason, right, some people at this point may want to try to buy something cheap.
Thanks a lot for that call. Back to your calls now. Brian is with us in La Crosse. Brian, hi.
Hi. Thanks for the show. Not concerned. Is more so just the question about the end. When the coronavirus finally starts to ebb, because it is a viral thing and it will end and this will all be history, how long is it going to take for the stock market to get back to where the volatility is, you know, what we expect to be normal, and the stock values returning to their what should be appropriate levels, especially considering all the changes that are taking place in transportation, the NCAA championships being canceled, sports venues being canceled. I mean, the economy is taking a massive, massive hit. And as then you factor in the 14-day quarantine for people that do get infected by this, we're talking potential loss of wages and stuff. So how long-term are the implications of this, and to what degree should we, or when should we see the stock market rally?
Brian, thanks for the call. Bjorn, I won't ask you to predict the future, but how do you try to answer a question like that?
Well, I think that's the $100 question, or maybe like a $100 trillion question that everybody is interested in, because if we knew the answer to the college question, I think we'd all be trying to trade on that. But the problem is that we don't know the answer. So we don't know what the economic impact of this coronavirus epidemic is going to be. We don't know how long it's going to last. We don't know how many people are going to be affected. And more importantly than that, even we don't, for the state of the stock market, we don't know how deep the recession is going to be and how long it's going to last. So, and with these kind of uncertainties, there are always these kind of unforeseen things that will happen in the wake of this. What kind of companies will survive, which ones will not survive, and so on and so forth. So it's very difficult to answer that question. And this is why, to a large extent, why prices are going down.
As our caller said, the economy is taking a massive hit. And it makes me wonder, you know, is it just that the coronavirus in and of itself is that bad and creating that much uncertainty? Or is this something that might be revealing flaws, problems that are already there in the market, that it was overvalued? How would you assess something like that?
Well, you know, it's hard to say, was it overvalued? Probably it was. The valuations were very high before this happened. I've been skeptical of what's been happening with stock prices for the last several years. But of course, there was always the potential that it would fall a lot, given that the prices were so high to begin with. If you go back a month, they were at an all-time high. And, of course, that creates the possibility of the prices going down dramatically. But I think the main problem here is the uncertainty about how this will impact the real economy. What kind of a recession will we have come out of this, and how long is it going to last? So I think that is the fundamental uncertainty. I think the market would have gone down even if it wasn't extremely high to begin with, given this news, obviously.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to Bjorn Urocker from the UW-Madison Wisconsin School of Business. Back to your calls now. Steve is on the line in New Glarus. Steve, hello.
Hello. Yes, I have a question. I'm a disabled veteran, and I'm 100% disabled. I can't go back to work anywhere. My income is all in the one income I have is in the local bank here and in the credit union. And I'm just a little concerned about how safe are the banks and the credit unions right now.
Steve, great question. Go ahead, Bjorn.
Yeah, banks are insured there's no reason to be concerned about bank deposits. This is not a financial crisis. This is not a banking crisis. And even if it was, the banks are insured by the federal government, so your savings are fine.
All right. Thanks. I hope that helps you relax at least a little bit. Thanks for that call. Eric joins us now in Madison. Eric, hello.
Hi. I know one thing. When the market goes up, it affects me very little. But when it tanks, the effects are exponential. We're all going to be doomed, I think. Thanks.
Okay, Eric, thanks for the call. Eric, worried that when things start to crash like this, a lot of people are going to feel the brunt in terms of maybe job losses, things like that. Bjorn, how worried should we be?
I don't think it's going to get that bad. I think we're going to have a recession. I think this virus and the crisis is going to be over. I don't think I want to pile on to the doomsday talk about this. So.
So are there, as you look at efforts by the federal government, are there things that historically in a situation like this, if we can say, if we can compare one situation to another, are there efforts that historically seem to pay off in limiting the damage from market drops and market uncertainty like this?
Well, what they usually will do is to lower interest rates, but we're at a point now the rates are only at 100 basis points or 101%. They're probably going to lower the rate to zero shortly, and it's probably not going to have a whole lot of effect on the stock market. So the big uncertainty now is how do we deal with the pandemic and how quickly can we recover and how quickly can we get back to work.
Bjorn, as we wrap up, can you give us a couple tea leaves you're watching for to see how this is going to play out in the future?
Well, I think today was extreme. I really do think so. Oftentimes what you see when the market drops dramatically like it did today, you can go back and look at historically what happened in other crisis periods. If you look at the day after the crash of 87, the market recovered quite a bit. The same after the crash in 1929, we had some big bounce backs, and it may well happen here. This volatility that we experience now, I think, is going to be here to stay for a little while until we figure out how to stop this pandemic. But if the better estimates of where we are at the top of that, when we get on top of the pandemic, I think things are going to level off. Volatility is going to go down, and the prices are going to recover.
Bjorn, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Bjorn Aracher is the Bill Nygren Chair of Investments and Professor of Finance at the Wisconsin School of Business at UW-Madison. He was with us to talk about what the Dow Jones and other major indices are and what they say about our current economy. Coming up, Joe Biden won four more states in this week's Democratic primary contests, extending his delegate lead over Bernie Sanders. We'll look at where the race stands today and what it could mean for Wisconsin's voting next month. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 6 on the morning show, The Sap Must Flow. Get ready for a Wisconsin weekend with a look at maple syrup production in the state. And you can share your own stories and secrets of the best syrup. That's tomorrow at 6 on the morning show. Now, Joe Biden's presidential campaign got another boost this week, winning Democratic primaries in four states, Missouri, Mississippi, Idaho, and the biggest prize of the night, Michigan, a state Bernie Sanders had won in 2016. He's also leading in Washington, which was seen as a progressive stronghold for Sanders. Biden's campaign appeared to be in big trouble until he won South Carolina 2 weeks ago, followed by several of his primary opponents dropping out of the race. In his victory speech Tuesday, Biden said it's time for Democrats to unite to defeat President Trump.
As I said from the beginning, this election is the one that has character on the ballot. The character of the candidates, the character of the nation is on the ballot. It's more than a comeback, in my view, our campaign. It's a comeback for the soul of this nation. This campaign is taking off, and I believe we're going to do well from this point on.
Biden now leads Sanders in the delegate count, 864 to 710. Not done yet, though. You need 1,991 to secure that nomination. Meanwhile, the Trump campaign insisted the president is on a, quote, unstoppable drive toward reelection. Lily Gorin is a professor of political science and global studies at Carroll University in Waukesha. She's the co-author of Mad Men in Politics, Nostalgia and the Remaking of Modern America, and Women in the White House, Gender, Popular Culture, and Presidential Politics. She's an expert in American politics, the presidency, Congress, and public policy. Lily, good to have you back with us.
Thanks for having me on today.
Well, a dramatic turnaround in this Democratic primary. Joe Biden seemed to be just losing after the first couple few states.
It wasn't just after the first couple of few states. It was even before voters were voting in Iowa and New Hampshire. And he had some lackluster performances in the debates. And while he had some front runner status in a number of polls, there was a lot of discussion about whether or not he was, you know, sort of coasting, as it were. But after the South Carolina primary, now a little over 2 weeks ago, if you can imagine that, that, you know, he sort of has the lead in terms of delegates and also really strong sort of outcomes in a whole variety of states.
We hear about the concept of momentum in these races. And I got to say, Lily, I kind of think it, you know, we overstate it sometime and it's just this sort of press notion. But it seems like South Carolina changed the momentum. Why is it that one state seems to have turned things around so much?
Well, I think it wasn't necessarily that it turned things around so much. It did for Biden. But I think what you had initially is you had unclear results in Iowa, in part because of the mechanism that was used to tally the votes. And so you had a number of days where you had no clarity with regard to who had actually won, but it was also quite close. So you had unclear results in Iowa. You had sort of not as clear decisive vote outcome in New Hampshire in terms of knocking a bunch of people out of the race. You had, again, caucuses in Nevada where Bernie Sanders won the caucuses. But again, so you have outcomes with Pete Buttigieg and Amy Klobuchar and Bernie Sanders and all of these candidates in the Democratic primary. And then you have this fairly decisive outcome in South Carolina. And that's followed immediately by sort of the consolidation in the field with Klobuchar and Buttigieg getting out before Super Tuesday. And so I think it was sort of a variety of different components that ultimately then led to, you know, the sort of comeback of Joe Biden, but it was also that the fragmentation in the Democratic field was sort of going on in these one-by-one primaries and caucuses.
Let's talk about everybody dropping out of the race. Now, I remember when Scott Walker dropped out of the race for president, former Wisconsin governor, he said other people should follow his example and unite around an alternative to the front runner named Donald Trump then.
Right.
That didn't happen. Donald Trump won the nomination. Something very different happened with Democrats here. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think that there was a lot of thinking about what happened in 2016 with regard to the Republican primary and the fact that you had so many candidates who were vying for the nomination. And the whole time sort of Trump was positioned as a factional candidate, but either winning or coming in second in so many races that nobody was able to unite around particular candidates, in part because there were quite a few. I mean, I remember in 2016 when this Wisconsin essentially was Ted Cruz's last stand, even though he won it in the nomination fight. And I think that was something that Democrats, the establishment, voters in general sort of were looking at options and sort of saying we don't want to have that same experience.
Talking to Lily Gorin from Carroll University in Waukesha about the latest in the Democratic primary. Senator Bernie Sanders still in the race. He held a news conference yesterday saying, hey, his policies remain popular, he says, especially with younger voters, and Democrats can't afford to ignore him or his supporters.
Today I say to the Democratic establishment, in order to win in the future, you need to win the voters who represent the future of our country, and you must speak to the issues of concern to them. You cannot simply be satisfied by winning the votes of people who are older.
What do you make of that message from Senator Sanders and some of what he said about what he plans to do in the debate, the scheduled debate with former Vice President Biden?
Well, and again, you know, if you look at the survey data coming out of the election this past week or the week before, is that the skew towards Biden and towards Sanders really does break down along demographic lines. that younger voters absolutely are, you know, 70-80% voting for Sanders, and older voters to that same number are generally voting for a Biden. And so Sanders' argument, which is, you know, essentially you should listen to younger people who are going to be around longer, is also valid. But as I always say to my students all the time, every time we talk about this, that the younger voters don't come out and vote as much as older voters do. And this is a problem across the board because there is a lot of capacity there, but they don't, you can't necessarily rely on the folks who are 18 to 24 to propel a candidacy to the White House.
Looking at the road ahead for Senator Sanders, if he has a shot still at this nomination, what would have to happen in the remaining states?
He would have to do extremely well in terms of amassing the delegates going towards the convention in Milwaukee in the summer. And at this point, you know, the math is not necessarily working in his favor. It's possible, but the structure also of the primaries moving forward are ones that are not necessarily places and states where Senator Sanders did well in 2016. So some of the places that he did particularly well in, like Washington State, like Michigan, are already behind him. And so it's going to be harder for him to get enough delegates to surpass Biden at this point, although it's not impossible.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Casey is with us in Algoma. Casey, hi.
Hi, how are you doing today?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Casey?
So earlier you were talking about Nevada, and I would consider that a decisive victory. The mishap in Iowa, Pete Buttigieg declaring victory, New Hampshire coming up, Pete Buttigieg declaring victory. I'm not saying that this is rigged, but I'm saying that there's a manufactured effort by both media and the party to push a potentially very flawed candidate in Biden. And the thing about youth vote, it is, in fact, up. It just turns out that older voters are also turning out more than they were in the past. I think that Biden hasn't been vetted, and Biden won't be vetted by the mainstream media because they have a vested interest in retaining the status quo. The status quo, the soul that Joe Biden wants to get back to, is the exact soul that led us to Trump and has led us to 50 years of wage stagnation. Sanders is a better general election candidate. And if they would have pushed a narrative like they have in the past, winner in Iowa, winner in New Hampshire, big winner in Nevada, we would have a whole different conversation. But it's a system that's built against a coalition that's multi-generational and multicultural. And it's a shame to see what the party and the media is doing to somebody that has legit policies. You know, and even one more thing, I apologize. Exit polls have shown after every state, on average, 30% of people are in favor, or by a percentage of 30, people are in favor of the elimination of private health care and replacing it with Medicare for all.
Casey, thanks a lot for the call. So I think a lot of Bernie Sanders supporters agree with Casey. They feel they get unfair treatment from the Democratic establishment and the media, Lily.
And I, you know, I understand exactly what he's saying, but I am also looking at what I saw in the news, in reading and seeing what happened in Iowa in terms of the outcome, which again was not completely clear at the time, and you know, it's remained sort of murky. And Sanders did, as I noted, have a clear win, a decisive win in the caucuses in Nevada. But then you turn around and the next election is in South Carolina, where Biden had an even more decisive win. So it's hard to sort of say, okay, Bernie Sanders had a decisive win in the caucuses in Nevada, and then Joe Biden had a decisive win in the primary in South Carolina, and then 3 days later went on to have a fairly decisive win in quite a few states. And that's the voters talking. That's not the media talking.
Casey, thanks a lot for that call. We're talking about the latest in the presidential race with Lily Gorin, professor of political science and global studies at Carroll University in Waukesha. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Which candidate are you supporting for president and why, whether that's within the Democratic field? much smaller than it was not that long ago, or President Trump, or another alternative? Do you support Bernie Sanders' decision to stay in the race, whether you support him or not? Do you think it's good to have that competition extended? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're looking at the race for president. Joe Biden has a 154 delegate lead over Bernie Sanders after racking up some more victories this week. Lily Gorin is with us, professor of political science and global studies at Carroll University in Waukesha. And you can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, hopes, and fears for the presidential race. And what, if anything, does this virus outbreak, the COVID-19 outbreak, mean for politics in this country? Call 800-642-1234. Back to your calls. Margaret is with us in Madison. Margaret, hi.
Hi. Say, Lily, fascinating discussion. And I hope you all saw the analysis in New York Times this morning. Fascinating. The Biden depth of support. I think he won every single county in Michigan, every single county in Missouri, and every single county in Mississippi. It was an incredible breadth of victory for a campaign that just a few weeks ago really had no staff and no money. And I think what that shows is that people are so focused on beating Donald Trump, they are voting for the man that they think can do it.
Margaret, thanks a lot for the call. Lily, what do you think?
I mean, I think that Margaret is pointing out something that's really interesting about the Biden campaign is that there is this pretty deep support where you see the outcome in some of these races. There's truly lopsided. And that it's indicative, again, of the fact that I think Margaret's conclusion may be also accurate in terms of people wanting to see somebody who they think can really take on Donald Trump. And I'm not saying that Bernie Sanders could not or cannot, but that the voters are suggesting that, in their opinion, as Democratic voters, that they see Biden as more viable in that regard. But I also wanted to loop back to something that Casey had mentioned with regard to where voters stand on a lot of the policy issues that Senator Sanders and also Senator Warren had been advocating for on the campaign trail. And a lot of these issues are probably to the left of where Biden is on policy issues, but that the Democrats themselves are looking for advocacy on. So it may be that if Biden is the nominee, that the policy issues that he campaigns on and that the Democratic Party campaigns on, in fact, may be coming more from the campaigns and articulations that Sanders and Warren have been making in their sort of roles on the campaign trail.
Thanks for the call, Margaret. We'll bring on Marcy now in Manitowoc. Marcy, hello.
Hello. I think it's well known that the Republicans vote Democratic in the primaries for the weakest candidate to go against Trump. And they come out in groves to vote in order to get their candidate who they think would not be able to beat Trump in the election.
And okay, Marcy, thanks for the call. She's saying that Republicans vote for the Democrat in primaries in states where they can do that, who are the weakest. I know there were in South Carolina, there's a Republican campaign. I don't know how much it made a difference to get Republicans to vote for Bernie Sanders. Have you seen that kind of effort to get Republicans to intervene in the Democratic primary, Lily?
I mean, I've seen that there's been advocacy with regard to that. But again, that varies state to state, because if you're not in an open primary, then it's a lot more difficult to do that, to take the ballot from a party that may not be your own. And in places like New York State, it's actually impossible to do that because you have to go with the party that you're, quote, registered for. And so it varies, again, based on the laws and the regulations state by state with regard to primary access and whether it's an open primary.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to Lily Gorin from Carroll University in Waukesha about the presidential race. Before I go back to our callers, Lily, I want to talk about this factor that's in this race that we don't usually see, this epidemic, this disease outbreak of COVID-19 pandemic, I should say. Sorry. Of course, it means a lot of things outside of politics. What do you watch for in terms of how it's affecting how candidates on both sides are going to run here?
Well, I mean, again, we sort of have this moving and evolving situation, and you know, many of us academics, we are being sort of put in a position where we're taking a lot of our coursework online. So each of us is being affected by it in many, many different ways. And the candidates are themselves, both Biden and Sanders, were asked by the Republican governor in Ohio, DeWine, to not hold rallies in Cleveland. And so they did not hold those rallies. And so you have this situation where, you know, on campaigns, you expect to have a lot of handshaking and open engagement. And when the epidemiologists and the medical professionals are telling us all to socially distance ourselves, then it's really going to have an impact on those kind of events. How that will also affect the primaries going forward, whether people will come out to vote as much or not, yet to be seen. And also, when you start thinking about the college populations, if you have been told by your university that we're closed down physically for the rest of the semester and everything is going online, you may be voting in your home location as opposed to your university location, which also may complicate young people's voting. And again, the 18 to 24-year-old demographic is one that is not used to voting. I mean, this is what all of the studies say. And so further complications may, in fact, depress some of the youth voting because of the COVID-19 issues.
Let's go back to our callers now. Rick is with us in Evansville. Rick, hello.
Hey there. Yeah, I was just calling. Number one, I want to touch base on the idea that, you know, Iowa and Biden's complete and utter failure in Iowa should be significant, but the primary reason that I believe that Senator Sanders should stay in the race and continue to campaign as well as he can under the circumstances is to press the central issues of the central part of the Democratic Party and drag Joe Biden and the conservative corporate side of the Democratic Party back over to where the Democratic Party should be.
Rick, thanks for the call. That gets to some of what you were talking about earlier, Lily. Do you think Bernie Sanders staying in the race longer will help accomplish what Rick hopes it does, bringing the Democratic nominee, if it's Joe Biden, further to the left?
Well, I think it will push not only the nominee, but also the party potentially in that direction in terms of having advocacy with regard to policy that the Democrats will have a discussion of in Milwaukee, theoretically, this summer at the convention, what the platform says, what other Democrats will be running on. And so I think that, you know, sort of Sanders' candidacy, again, nobody's gotten enough delegates yet. So I don't think that this is over by any stretch of the imagination. But Sanders' candidacy has certainly been advocating for policies that many Democrats support, even if they may not always support the sort of tribune of those policies.
Rick, thanks for that call. Lily, I want to take a minute or so to look at Wisconsin before we're out of time. We've got this April 7th primary. We're waiting to see if it's going to matter. Are we still going to, well, you can't predict the future, but do you think we're still going to have candidates to choose from by the time that comes around?
I think we probably will still have candidates to choose from. And I still think, you know, I always tell all of my students to go out and vote. When the opportunities present themselves, go out and vote. And so I would not want to turn anybody off from doing that. And again, none of the candidates in the Democratic Party have yet reached that magic number for the nomination. So by the time we roll around to April in Wisconsin, there may be more delegates allocated. But again, neither of the candidates may have reached that threshold.
And there's a thought that the Democratic primary could affect our race for state Supreme Court justice. What are you watching for there?
Well, again, there's, you know, usually when you have a presidential primary, it usually pulls more people out to vote. So the potential is that there will be more voters who come out to vote in that April primary, and that may have an impact on the judicial race. But again, this is possibly working against the COVID-19 issue, and I don't know how that's going to impact voter turnout.
Lots of variables, Lily. Thanks a lot for joining us, as always.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me on today.
Lily Gorin is a professor of political science and global studies at Carroll University in Waukesha. She's the co-author of Mad Men in Politics, Nostalgia, and the Remaking of Modern America, and other books. We talked to her today about the latest in the race for president. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, this month marks the anniversary of the passage of Act 10 in Wisconsin, which drastically limited the activities of public employee unions. We'll have the first of two conversations about the impact of Act 10. Plus, it's this week's edition of Food Friday with cooking inspiration from Native American cuisine. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.